And this is WBAI New York. Stay tuned for Cat Radio Cafe. Radio Cafe, a magazine of the arts, on listeners, sponsored, non-commercial, WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5. Yikes. I'm Janet Coleman, and you're...
David Dozer.
The... He just plays playwright. I'm just... humming along here as I work my way into this microphone. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Janet.
Yeah.
What's new?
What's new? We're going to be another kind of radio person, Alice, on elsewhere, in another city, in
fact.
Oh,
no, don't tell me we got a job.
In 23 other cities, yes.
Oh.
I think it's happening on Saturday.
That's a lot of commuting.
We have to rush around.
Rush around to 23 cities? Big ones like Schenectady? And,
I don't know how small they can be.
What the heck and all that?
If they're not New York, what the heck are they? All right, well, I'll tell you what this is called. It's called, the show's called Been There, Done That. Those of you who have internet access, you can hop on your internet, go to google.com and look up Been There, Done That. And it's a program originating out of Philadelphia, WHYY. It's stars Marty Goldenson, who used to be a fixture at WBAI.
And then what did he do wrong?
Spoke up.
Oh.
He's fresh.
He didn't say anything untoward on our air, did he?
I don't know.
I mean their air.
I guess he did. Untoward, what does that mean?
I don't know.
It means fresh.
Facing the wrong direction?
Can't
not,
do that.
Not toward where they
dead,
want it.
Dead center.
Yeah.
Right.
Non-toward, that would be.
Non-toward. Now, the other exciting part is that PoisonArts.com is being fed new chapters, new audio chapters of Poison Arts every minute, thanks to Otis and Scoot, Otis McClay in Houston. It's helping us to organize that site that we share. And I think as of tonight, CatRadioCafe.com takes its position on the internet. And it will have all sorts of archive broadcasts. And since I don't know what people do when they have there, we're going to have a good, fun time, right?
Oh,
we're going to have little cats and everything. We're going to have
I mean visuals for the radio viewers.
All of that. Well, there's more stuff that we're going to be doing, and I'll tell you more about it as the evening goes on. But I do want to say that tonight's guests are what? Did you have something you can say?
No, I was just going to, while people were at Google there, you sent
them
to Google.
Oh, at Google. Tell them to look
They could search for Hackers, the movie.
Yeah.
Where I heard Emmanuel Goldstein a week ago on Off the Hook, his program, Tuesday nights here, WBAI, 8 to 9 o'clock, mentioned that you could, people who wanted the full version of Hackers, the movie.
The uncut.
Uncut on DVD, you could sign this survey and say you want it. And if enough people want it, MGM supposedly will
release it.
Come right out with that. Now, the reason we're so interested is...
our scenes were cut.
Yes, we happen to be the principal and the vice principal
at Stuyvesant High School.
Stuyvesant High School, so... we were,
right.
Our scene, we frequently get parts in movies where we stand around going like, oh, look, did you see the action that just occurred with the main stars? Yes, I did. I hope everyone else did, too. And they go later,
we don't
let's
need
cut
that
out. We don't need that. What do we have characters talking about what just happened? And so if they get in touch with MGM via the website.
Ask for it. Say you want that. You just want that uncut copy.
Yeah, and then, you know, especially all you crickets out there, if you could communicate telepathically, I think we could do some good, too. Thank you.
Okay. Well, there's still millions more announcements. It just happened to
be right
one of those announcey nights, but we'll get to it later because I want to announce who's on tonight. We're going to have a little interview shortly with the great Nat Hentoff, our foremost authority in the area of the First Amendment, an expert on the Bill of Rights, who's been doing a series on Ashcroft and a danger to our civil liberties. And... we'll be Don Nathantoff up shortly. And we also have here in the studio James Sanders, who's the author of a sort of fantastic new book on the fantastic celluloid skyline, New York, and the movies. And we'll be really about the interplay between the skyline or the city of New York and its influence on film and the influence of the film back on our dreams and imagination of a big city. And so like that. And if we have any time, we'll be taking your calls because I think there's sufficient celluloid in our collective memory to come up with some thoughts about it ourselves. We have seen so many films and seen so much of our city, those of us who live here. And don't just eat lunch all the time. Right? Don't just take a cab and go to the nearest lunch spot.
Never.
Who's that? Someone who eats lunch coming in? No.
Yes, it's the lunch is being delivered for tomorrow, I think. They like to have a lot of lunch here early.
All right. So, the great friend that Nat Hentoff and I have in common is Charles Mingus. Hentoff's a jazz authority, was an associate editor of Downbeat for a number of years when he returned from Paris in the schoolish fashion. And he was Mingus's great confidant and consulter. And so let's hear a little Mingus while we dial up Nat Hentoff. Mingus would kill us for talking over the music. That was Don't Be Afraid, the Clown's Afraid Too, sort of timely music all over again, isn't it?
Well, that reminded me that from time to time, early in the morning, or tonight at noon, as it were, I'd pick up the phone and I'd hear music. Music I hadn't heard before, but I recognized the composer. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, Mingus would come on and say, "Well, what do you think of that?" And I was very honored to think that he'd asked my advice.
Yeah, yeah. He trusted you implicitly. He would, in times like this, I think, solicit your advice.
And well, it was mutual because I learned a lot from Charles.
Yeah. This is a particular time of year for Mingus. It's the eggnog time. Do you have any specific memories of the Mingus eggnog?
I remember hearing about them, but I never shared an eggnog with Charles.
Well, it was something. Let me tell you, you lived for those eggnogs. Once you had one, that was it. That's, you just waited a whole year till the next Christmas or New Year's or whatever. It had, like, everything in it.
Well, when he was in the mood, nobody could celebrate better.
No, he was excessive to the max.
Right.
Now, you've been doing a series, an incredible series in the Village Voice, sort of a very courageous series, too, under the circumstances.
Not courageous so far. I mean, the FBI hasn't come visiting, though they might be listening in tonight, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah? Is this where they go? I thought we were under the radar. Back in good again, I guess, for the FBI. You have raised the real danger to our civil liberties with the imposition of the What's this called again? The Patriot Act?
U.S. Patriot Act.
U.S.
Yes.
Patriot Act. Somehow it feels like it should have a K in there. Patriot, two T's. And you've been writing about it in The Voice. And last week, I guess it's off the stands now, the issue in which you raised the possibility that we could form a... that it was time, really, for a civil right, a movement for civil rights that was reminiscent of that in the Bayard Rustin and Martin Luther King were able to create.
I was remembering very vividly, because a lot of it was on WBAI in those days,
mm-hmm.
with Bob Fass and others. The anti-war and the civil rights movement started when the popularity polls indicated that only a minority, if that, of Americans were in favor of either.
Mm-hmm.
But after some teach-ins, not only at college campuses, but at town meetings and ads in newspapers, and in terms of civil rights, the climactic March on Washington in 1963, which Bayard almost single-handedly organized for practically nothing, the direction of the country changed.
Yeah.
And though the odds seem very longer now because there is such a popularity quotient for the president,
mm-hmm.
I'm beginning to see that there is a good chance. Last week in the New York Times, a front page story, one of their polls, indicated that some of the people were being a little nervous about what John Ashcroft was doing. And, of course, it's Ashcroft and Bush, because they're beginning to realize that some of these, it's not only the USA Patriot Act, but some of what's followed. Like, for example, Ashcroft is now reinstituting the COINTELPRO division of the FBI. Now, that was the most disgraceful part of the FBI's
yeah.
history, and that's saying quite a lot.
So they're actually officially reviving it and cleaning out the offices?
It's in the planning stage, and it's been confirmed not only by the Times, but by the Wall Street
mm-hmm.
Journal, and they should know.
Mm-hmm.
And what COINTELPRO did was to monitor, not only monitor, but infiltrate and disrupt all kinds of religious and political organizations, not just people allegedly involved with the Communist Party, but people who disagreed with the administration on Vietnam, on civil rights, and all kinds of things.
And
it was so bad what they did that the Church Committee, named after Frank Church, a very good senator from Idaho, back in 1975, pledged to the American people that never again would we be subject to this kind of, as he put it, vigilante organization that was designed and implemented to punish people for exercising their free speech First Amendment rights. Well, that pledge is being broken.
Mm-hmm.
And also people are beginning to realize, if they begin to understand what's in some of this legislation, that, for example, there's a, as an aspect of the USA Patriot Act, that brings back what was called in J. Edgar Hoover's day the black bag jobs.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, the FBI, without a warrant, would come into your home or
mm-hmm.
office when you weren't there, take what they wanted, and disappear. And
mm-hmm.
you never knew what they had taken.
Would they similarly leave what they wanted?
Pardon me?
Would they similarly leave what they wanted at your house?
In the case of Daniel Ellsberg and some other people, they would leave, as they say in the trade, a bug.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. either a wiretap
mm-hmm.
or some other listening device.
Mm-hmm.
But now, under the USA Patriot Act, they get a warrant, but they still come in when you're not there. They can take whatever they find. They can look at your hard drive, copy that, and when they leave, according to federal regulations, they're supposed to leave, as it were, a receipt saying, hey, we've been there, this is
mm-hmm.
what we've taken.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way, right afterwards, you can challenge it in court.
Mm-hmm.
Did they have the right address? Did they have the right to come in, et cetera?
Yeah.
But now you wait for not only 90 days, that's what the Justice Department says, but they can indefinitely continue not letting you know they've been there. And that can go on indefinitely because in these times, it's hard to imagine any judge would say to an FBI agent who wants to extend this period, oh, no, you can't do it. Now, if people begin to know, and I wish the press were a little more diligent in telling people what's in this legislation, people begin to know that this new kind of black bag job first of all, doesn't apply only to non-citizens.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't apply only to people suspected of involvement in terrorism. It is now part of criminal investigations. Mm-hmm. And the other kicker is, while the law itself, the Anti-Terrorism Act, has what's called a sunset clause, which is kind of ludicrous, but it says that in 4 years, Congress will look at it again to see if they've gone too far.
If there is a Congress.
Well, it's not more to that point is, if indeed, and I've done some research on Al-Qaeda way beyond bin Laden, if this continues, if these invisible enemies continue, in 4 years, it's very difficult to imagine anybody but Russ Feingold of Wisconsin saying, as he already has, the only senator who voted against the bill, hey, we've gone too far. So that the sunset clause won't apply then to the rest of the bill, but the point about these black bag jobs, they're not sunsetted. That's now a part
really?
Of permanent law.
Hmm.
And if people begin to realize, so there is a beginning, and there are various news organizations, news associations around the country that are holding town meetings to explain to people what's in this law. And the thing that gives me some degree of hope, during the alleged debate on the anti-terrorism bill, the USA Patriot Act, the ACLU put together the most extensive list of organizations opposed to that kind of bill, from right to left, people in the center, for example, from Gun Owners of America to People for the American Way.
Mm-hmm.
And if these groups, or at least some of them, can begin to organize and let people know what's going on, that to know, for example, I'll give you a quick story. In terms of this military tribunal that Bush has ordered, where he is the only person who will decide who's going to be tried by a military tribunal, and if the person is convicted, the only people he can appeal to is Bush or Donald Rumsfeld. Mm-hmm. The original order, they pretend to be backing away from it now, the original order, which I have, says that there shall be no appeal from this military tribunal to any court in the United States, which means the Supreme Court, which means there is no habeas corpus.
Astonishing.
Now, the point of all this is the administration uses as their chief example of a precedent for this what happened in 1942 when 8 Nazi saboteurs were caught coming into this country in a submarine trying to blow up various things. They were caught not by J. Edgar Hoover, who took the credit. Actually, two of them went to the Coast Guard and wanted to save themselves, and they were the ones who told what was going on. But then there was an open hearing which went to the Supreme Court. By the way, the military tribunal that Bush wants will be closed for the most part. There was an open hearing, and what Bush and his chief advisor, legal advisor Al Gonzalez, and everybody else says, see, the Supreme Court did what the president now wants to do. What they don't tell you is that Franklin Delano Roosevelt told the attorney general, who was Francis Biddle at the time, and this is in Biddle's memoirs, he said, I don't care what the court is going to do. I'm going to execute these people.
Mm-hmm.
Biddle then went to Owen Roberts, who was on the court, told him that. Roberts told his brethren, there were no women on the court then, and the Chief Justice, Charles Evans Hughes, was aghast. He wasn't only being intimidated, he was being threatened. And that's why there was an 8-0 verdict, which most of the justices regretted later. So this precedent is based on an illegal, to say the least, threat on the United States Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of stuff that the press really ought to be going at. Only two people I know have written about it, and that's Toni Morrow with Legal Times, and I forget her name, but she writes for Bloomberg News.
On the contrary, they keep reinforcing the precedent in the Fox News and the cable stations. They keep reinforcing.
Well, Fox News, which used to have a very good 6-7 program because they had two good reporters on it, Jim Angle and Carl Cameron, especially Angle. But now they've become totally supporters of the war, and it's hard to find any dissent, except they have a judge named Napolitano, I think, who occasionally clashes with some of the... But that's the point is, most people get their news these days from television, and more from cable television, and while you can find out a lot about what's going on in the caves in Afghanistan, there's very little I'll tell you another thing that really makes me very angry. If you watch the daily press briefings by Ari Fleischer, which is a penalty unto itself.
It is indeed.
Here you have the Washington elite corps. Now, the day that Bush signed the USA Patriot Act, the press conference took place maybe 2 or 3 hours later. There were only a few very superficial questions about the law, and since then, practically none of those people have had any kind of substantive, I don't care about an objection, but ask about the military tribunal, mm-hmm. ask about the reintroduction of COINTELPRO, ask about the black bag judge. I mean, the Washington press corps is really awful.
They're very, very docile. They're on television for one of the things. They're afraid of being unpopular with Ari Fleischer. and so what position does that leave? I mean, if we scan our list of Bill of Rights and how they're all threatened, what about our favorite amendment? The First Amendment. What are we going to do with that?
Well, first of all, exercise it.
Uh-huh.
And at the beginning, there were at least two reporters. One of them was a city editor who also wrote a column in two papers around the country who were fired just because they criticized on the day of September 11th, they criticized Bush for not coming right back to Washington. Mm-hmm. They were fired because they were somehow sullying the chief executive. Some of the newspapers are fighting back, and a lot's going to depend on the degree to which people insist. And I know this sounds pie-in-the-sky stuff, but
especially to us here at WBAI.
Well, I have a long history with WBAI, way back in the early 60s, before it was given to Pacifica Radio. Gunther Schiller and I had a jazz program on the BAI when it was at the Hotel Pierre.
Really? Way before it even existed?
Yeah, and then I knew Lou Schweitzer, the very rich man who owned the station, and he was telling me one night at the Village Gate when John Coltrane was there, Schweitzer said, I'm going to give this to Pacifica because I think there has to be more diversity on radio, more free speech.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was. I mean, all during the 60s, listening to BAI, which we did every night, was just extraordinary in terms of this was real free speech radio. Mm-hmm. I expect KPFA was like that too, mm-hmm. but BAI certainly was. And then from then on in, you had Allen Ginsberg on Pacifica and WBAI defying censors.
Right.
And, of course, the famous Pacifica Supreme Court case based on George Carlin's Seven Dirty Words.
Right.
We lost that mm-hmm. case, but it set a very important precedent in that it awakened a lot of people as to what censorship amounted to in terms of broadcast. But then, especially at BAI, by the way, I've been on, I was on since then, usually talking about, of all things, censorship. But after the Christmas coup, I would tune in and I'd hear some of the current members of the staff ask for listener contributions to free speech radio. And it reminded me of 1984, George Orwell's, war is peace, slavery is freedom.
Right.
And there was the banning and the firing and the suspending and the intimidation of a number of people on BAI, some of whom were indeed banned, for exercising, of all things, free speech. And now, and this really shocked me, and I'm not easily shocked after all these years, with Bob Fast, who is the epitome of free speech radio, has been suspended, and as I understand it, the suspension is indefinite, which seems to be a euphemism for being fired mm-hmm. by your new station director.
Mm-hmm.
And this is because he mentioned the settlement, which I just heard somebody mention before you went on the air. And it was also in the newspapers as well. So I told Bob Fass yesterday, having you fired from WBAI, it's as if they had locked James Madison out of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Now, if this settlement is real, and there is a newly constituted board with a majority that believes in free speech, it seems to me the most important thing this board can do, and do it immediately, is to eliminate the gag rule on all Pacifica stations. I understand it's called the dirty laundry rule.
Yeah, there is a dirty laundry rule.
Well, does that indicate that the administration there feels that the laundry is soiled? Anyway, how can you ask people for money to keep free speech radio alive when the people who work there can't even tell the listeners what's going on. I mean, that kind of concealing, repressing dissent is in the spirit of John Ashcroft, not the reason for listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. So it seems to me the Pacifica campaign, and I much admire the persistence against a lot of odds, but it can't stop, it seems to me, until Amy Goodman and Bob Fast and the rest of the exiles of conscience are back where they belong, and the Daughtrys and the Utrecht Leeds are only, at last, an instructive memory, along with, eventually, I hope, John Ashcroft. So,
oh,
I mean, this is a crucial point, because if this settlement turns out to be phony, then all this effort that's gone into Pacifica campaign will not be wasted, because I'm sure you folks are going to go on it again. But you really oughtn't to deceive the listeners twice. So it's very important where the majority of that board is, and very important to stop this gag rule nonsense and to bring back Bob Fass and bring Amy Goodman back home.
Hear, hear. And you said it. I didn't even have to open my mouth and break the gag rule. How about that? Well, Nat Hentoff, I want to thank you for being a beacon for the First Amendment and sharing this evening with us and restoring some confidence in our need to speak out and have faith in that amendment that the founding fathers knew to start the whole Bill of Rights with.
It's interesting. What little heat there has been so far on the administration, they're beginning to tell lies about what the original order of the military tribunal is. This new guy that they transported to Virginia, which, by the way, they picked Virginia for the trial, because that's the circuit court that is most for capital punishment.
Right.
But nonetheless, they do it in a civilian criminal court, when ordinarily, if you listen to Bush beginning, at the beginning, he'd be in a military tribunal now. So they're beginning to hear there is such a thing as dissent.
Yeah.
And when people with authoritarian... I mean, the one thing that Bush has done that's never been done so thoroughly before in our history, and we've had bad spots with the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798, Lincoln suspending habeas corpus and arresting all kinds of people who opposed his policies, the Red Scare after the First World War. But no administration has ever so totally ignored in many areas the separation of powers. The whole business with, for example, listening by wiretaps to a lawyer-client discussion in one of these prisons, they did that without consulting Congress or anybody else. They did the same thing with the military order.
Well, you know, Bush Sr. was on TV this morning sort of improvising punishments for terrorists. So maybe it runs in the family, you know, a sort of authoritarian streak. Inventiveness, punitive personalities.
Well, you know, the thing about George Bush Jr. is that he's always been tone deaf to civil liberties. When he was governor of Texas, he was not only the chief executioner of the United States, but he had the worst record in the country in terms of the basic civil liberties of people who were too poor to have a lawyer and get put into the slammer. Under Bush, they often had to wait weeks and sometimes longer before they could get a lawyer. When both houses of the Texas legislature, both the House and the Assembly and the Senate, who were usually at each other's throats, unanimously voted, this was a year and a half or 2 years ago, they voted for the first time in the history of Texas to have the equivalent of legal aid, a public defender, and Bush vetoed that bill. So this is nothing new for him. He just has a lot more power.
Well, we didn't elect him.
No, I voted for Ralph Nader. And where is he, by the way? He could be very useful now.
I don't know. Maybe he'll show up at the anniversary on the December
20th. Yeah, but he ought to be... I know he's back on the campus trail, but he ought to be talking more about raising some resistance so we can get back our rights.
I'm with you on that one. We're going to sort of have to leave you now, only to meet again before too long on the radio and keep us hopping here, okay?
Sure.
Keep reminding us what the chilling effect is, because it is chilling to be gagged.
And in the spirit of Charles Mingus, Speak Your Mind.
Speak Your Mind. Here's some Spirit of Charles Mingus, and this is WBAI New York.
Go on.
Cat Radio Cafe, listener-sponsored, non-commercial, WBAI New York. You were just listening to Nat Hentoff talking about civil liberties, and in the backdrop is Charles Mingus, who plays about civil liberties. I'm telling you, that's what he was doing. That's what he told me. That's what he told Nat Hentoff. And we're joined now, that's Duke Ellington's Sound of Love, played by the Mingus Big Band. And we're joined now by James Sanders, whose beautiful book is Celluloid Skyline, New York, and the Movies. Welcome to Cat Radio. Hope you can have a chance to exercise some civil liberties fast. Speak up, speak up. This is a grand book, a very original book. You, James Sanders, are an architect, and with Rick Burns, co-producer and co-author and co-creator of the series, the PBS series on New York. New York, a documentary film, which was just replayed recently and quite heart-stoppingly after the events of September 11th to see all this New York City skyline and street life dissected, and the homage to James Jacobs was beautifully executed. In Celluloid Skyline, you sort of describe the interplay between the city of New York and film, from the beginning of the film industry as it weaves its way west. You want to talk about those beginnings of New York and film and how we first were able to use the city as an image?
Well, a lot of people don't realize that just about the very first thing that anyone ever did with a movie camera was make movies in New York. The film industry was really born here. Thomas Edison got himself off his West Orange laboratory and started producing in 1896 the first commercial films. And these were not story films as they certainly weren't features as we think of them now. They were just short films that showed different sort of slices of life, little documentary style.
Were they called actualities?
Actualities, mm-hmm. Yeah. And they there were on all sorts of subjects, but they showed Teddy Roosevelt and they showed the Spanish-American War and scenes of Dewey coming back from Manila and that sort of thing. But the thing they kept coming back to again and again and again was New York. Part of the reason was just geographic. They were working around Union Square and Madison Square, and they could just, you know, take their cameras downstairs and have something fantastic to see. So they shot street life, they shot parades, they shot buildings being built, buildings being torn down. We actually used some of that footage in our series. And it was really sort of the first great love affair, the first great subject of the movies were these marvelous scenes of the city life. They're unimaginably poignant to watch today, because they are so unmediated. They just show you people walking on the street, and you wonder, who are these people?
The most improvised moments, the one that is gone, the street that is gone, most likely, the building and the human that is no longer here.
Absolutely. Yeah. You see young women and wonder, you know, how long did they live and when did they die and what families did they have? It's just
kind of like outtakes of the landscape.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
And that tradition of shooting in and around the city continued well through the teens and into the 20s. The features came along and they began to actually use the city skyline, the city environment as backdrop for features that were made in the New York area. And that went on. That was very, very popular. In the 1920s, you would have seen film crews zooming up and down the city streets with their silent cameras, and of course they had no sound equipment, so that was...
Were they simultaneously using studios to film comedy shorts at all? They had Nickelodeons about this time, didn't they?
They did. They had built, in some cases, quite substantial studio facilities in New York. The one that most people know is in Astoria, which came along in the early 1920s. But there were several others, and on 10th Avenue, Fox had two big studios there. There was William Randolph Hearst built one way up on about 126th Street. And they would shoot the indoor scenes in the studios, and then when it came time to sort of shoot the outdoor things, they would just sort of go down to the streets again and work around the city on rooftops. I have one amusing shot of a sort of Perils of Pauline type scene going on some midtown rooftop.
Actually, a body hanging off a
false parapet that had
been
built on top.
Before the Screen Actors Guild.
Well, there's a mattress below the actress in case she fell. It doesn't seem very much insurance. But by then, there was a rival. Hollywood had emerged. And, of course, it was a child of New York. The people who created it were, in large part, either born here or had passed through New York and sort of made their fortune here as theater owners.
Yeah, you kind of describe the earlier generation of filmmakers as techies, technicians, guys who made the camera work, who designed the innards, and this new bunch as members from the garment district, people who knew how to cut a year's fashion.
Well, that was the idea. They were the guys who stood at the back of the theater and sort of watched what audiences liked and disliked.
Right.
And it turned out that the art of making movies didn't really turn out to be too much about lenses and camera works, but knowing what the audience liked.
Right.
And they also, yes, they came as, you know, in large part from the garment industry, particularly from the luxury trades. There were glove makers and furriers.
Sam Goldwyn, huh?
Yeah, they had to gamble. They had to know what the audience, what people might like a year from now, and you had to be able to go with your instincts because the value of the thing was so expensive that if you guessed wrong or a couple of years in a row, you were out of business. That was something that would serve them very well. So they moved west and set up shop there. And my story takes a sort of a crucial turn at that point when sound comes in and everything changed. Suddenly you couldn't shoot on location anymore. So now you basically had to recreate New York.
So it wasn't only a matter of some guy having a high voice, some singer having a high voice. It really was an utter displacement. It was a whole new technology that had to be addressed, sound studios.
The cost of actually rewiring the studios was so high that they really couldn't afford to do it in New York.
Because it was too noisy.
Well, too expensive.
Uh-huh.
And they really had to consolidate their production in California.
So now they go west, and the founding fathers of the film go west, and what happens, as anybody who's ever moved west knows, the thing you miss is New York City.
Well,
if they only had New York City and Hollywood, and so they proceeded to do what?
Pretty much. There were sort of a series of, the sound brought on a sort of a series of events that sort of followed on one another. And the first was that you actually needed, first you had to make these films in the West. So you were going to have to rebuild the city on these lots that were in what were then really the suburbs of Los Angeles, in Edendale and Hollywood and places like that, and Burbank. And now the next thing about the talkies is the fact that they talked. You needed somebody to write all this dialogue. We all basically know this story. No one in California, or hardly anyone, was around to do this.
They couldn't even talk, let alone write.
Well, they had been writing printed titles for movies and things like that and coming up with all those chases. But they needed dialogue now. So they went to the people who knew how to write dialogue, novelists, playwrights, journalists, anybody who could do it. And this gigantic importation went on from about 1930 to about 1940 and on into the 40s. I do a list, a sort of a riff of just the names of the people that came.
William Faulkner, Dorothy Parker, Scott Fitzgerald.
Everybody, hundreds of others.
Robert Benchley,
name them. You just
name them.
I say, I think out of the six original creators of the New Yorker magazine, out of the ten original creators of New Yorker magazine, six had become Hollywood screenwriters, things like that. So then you had the situation where you had these, they wouldn't have come a few years earlier probably because New York was just too much fun in the 20s. But once the Depression hit and nobody really could afford to hire them at the rates they wanted, suddenly the money looked pretty good, and so they went across. And so I proposed somewhat, speculatively a little bit, but I think with some defense, that here were these guys. They were the most, and women, people like Dorothy Parker, they were the most urbane souls who had ever lived. They had just come from the most exciting New York in the 20s, sort of bursting with energy, prohibition, of course, making everything a little mad, but jazz and skyscrapers and taxi cabs and this theater and all this incredible thing. Now they're out in what is not the Los Angeles of today. There are no freeways.
Right.
There are no big buildings hardly at all.
Big orange groves.
It's everybody. Flatlands. Big city by population, but what everybody kept talking about was it was just sort of like an overgrown village that just went on and on and on. So they don't have anything of what they remember. So my proposal is simply that they just recreated it in their heads and then in their scripts. And then, in fact, built that city.
And, of course, in some ways embellished it and enhanced the memory of the city with, you know, elaborate sets. I mean, a Hollywood nightclub was 12 times larger than any possible nightclub in New York real estate. A skyline. There,
very much
you,
so,
you describe dozens of ways that set designers created this skyline to have a sort of enhanced, to satisfy the film, to bring that sense of height and dream quality to the film.
Yeah. Very much so. This is where the art directors kind of come in, because these guys, many of whom themselves were New Yorkers, there was Van Ness Pogliazzi from RKO and Cedric Gibbons from MGM, but in fact both were born in Brooklyn, bred in Brooklyn, fathers were architects. So they knew New York very well. And they and their teams of amazingly gifted designers pushed the whole thing. They kind of came up not just with what New York really had been, sort of the memory, but the imagination, what it could be, what it might be, what could happen there. Well, we'll have an ape climb the side of a building. Well, we'll have a giant nightclub on top. We'll have nightclubs on top of all the towers.
Right, on top of the towers. Well, talk a little bit about the creation of King Kong, because in some ways that act of imagination is so thrilling and so crazy that this guy had a dream himself of this giant monster on top of a very tall building. And it wasn't at first the Empire State Building, was it?
No, Marion C. Cooper, a real character, aviator, adventurer, and movie maker, was already very well known. He had made all these films shot in sort of distant Pacific islands.
Is he sort of a Howard Hughes-y guy?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. A real character. In fact, was later involved at, I can't remember which airline, but he was one of the crucial, it might have been Pan American, he was one of the crucial sort of founders of one of the major airlines. He had made these sort of wild animal movies. And he was back in New York for a few months. He was living in Manhattan. And he was thinking about the idea of, could he make a film about some giant wild animal, some giant kind of monstrous animal, come to the city and sort of rampaging around. But the thing that he couldn't think of was how was it going to end? What was going to be what he called the chariot race, and he was referring to Ben-Hur, and the original Ben-Hur, which was still a very popular movie at the time. And he said
always the chasing.
Always, you've got to have something at the end. And then the big chariot scene, he said, he looked up at the New York Life Building. That's the one with the sort of golden pyramidal top that's on Madison Square. And he saw an airplane come very close to it, sort of poignant now. Mm-hmm. And the light of the tower glinted off the plane, and he suddenly had this flash of inspiration. He said if he could figure out a logical way to get that giant monster up there and have it shot down by airplanes, he said, well, if that wasn't a chariot race, I don't know what is.
And he planned to be the pilot, didn't
he? That's what he and his partner, Schoedsack, actually put themselves in. That's a little in-joke. They're the pilots. And he said to Schoedsack, well, let's kill the son of a bitch ourselves.
I mean, a sort of Hitchcock thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. The movies also were able to convey about the city, the class differences in the city, just by nature of doing the sets to follow the fashion, you know. The townhouses were accurately rendered. The slums were sort of as well.
That was one of the great attractions about New York, I think, as a setting. You could put almost any kind of story here, whether it was the wealthiest people of society, the poorest. You could bring them together. There were dozens of films that were set in the mansions of Fifth Avenue, which were already, even in the 30s, sort of dying off. And that's what they showed, basically. They showed this kind of somewhat anachronistic way of life. If you look at movies like Holiday and My Man Godfrey, they're sort of enjoying the world, enjoying the luxury of it, but they're also suggesting in many, many ways, often by bringing outsiders into that world, that this is a world that's sort of on its way out and good riddance.
Right.
They also, much more bluntly, in a film like Dead End, for example, really basically used the fact that New York was then, and even more so now, is one of the very, very few places in the United States where rich and poor basically share space.
Mm-hmm.
It's not uniform, of course.
But they can be next door.
They can, and often are, close enough. And,
right.
And it is the most common thing in the world for the wealthiest and the poorest New Yorkers and everybody in between to sort of just all be on the same sidewalks. they would, film like Dead End actually used that as its premise and quite brilliantly then gave it a kind of architectural embodiment by putting an apartment house next to a tenement and so forth.
You know, the effeteness of the brownstone or the sort of the image you show here of the heiress, that kind of time gone by that Hollywood recognized as somewhat exhausted. Hollywood picked up on Art Deco and the sort of thrust of the energy of Art Deco, which really was expressed best in New York in the actual skyscraper and the actual thrust upward and the energy of this city. But they kind of took the Art Deco image and really embedded it into our fantasy life. The clothes, the homes, the nightclubs, the wit. The style of Art Deco is really a Hollywood, somehow a Hollywood creation, a magnification, rather, of whatever was really happening in New York. Why do you think that was so inspired in Hollywood?
I don't attach it so much to the Art Deco style, although that was a big part of the sort of look of these things. What I think was they found in these urban forums very powerful, expressive modes. They felt in the skyscraper what the skyscraper was trying to do, which was thrust itself up, push itself into the sky, aspire. And they felt, they saw this as an incredibly powerful theme or a thematic environment for New York and for America, for people trying to raise themselves up and climb and rise and sort of push themselves higher. And in all these environments, they were always sort of looking to what would activate them, what would bring out the meaning. And the sort of point of the book is really the larger idea, is simply that again and again these films would sort of dig deep into the meaning of the city and try to discover what it was to sort of propel their stories. And that was certainly true of the art of these great skyscrapers, which it's as if they created a race of people, a race of beings, we should say, King Kong and later on Batman and Metropolis and Ghostbusters.
And Gary Cooper.
Well, in a slightly different way.
Fountainhead.
To kind of, these were the authentic citizens of this amazing landscape. The people who actually had to go in and use the elevators were not. It was built for them, but the people who were really brought out the meaning of them were these figures who could leap, you know, 10 floors at a time and climb up the sides of them and so forth. You might ask, what other city could have given rise to those kind of characters?
And so as we look at the changing films over the decades, we see sort of the psychic manifestation of the city as it reaches Hollywood back and forth, back and forth. Now, what happens here? I mean, there was a film being made on West 4th Street today. I didn't know what the film was, and we talked a little bit about this because that is your mystery conclusion here. The film that we don't know, we don't really know what the film is. We see it as in progress on our streets. But when a film company, a film crew comes past your house or on your street is left changed. You know, when the Hello Dolly crew came to Garrison, New York, they changed Garrison, New York. They made it cuter. They made it more like a film. When they came to my butcher store, they made it cuter. They made it a cuter butcher store. When they come to the coffee shop down the street, even if Woody Allen is enhancing it, it becomes more filmic. It cutifies the city in a funny way. Because New York really isn't as pretty as Hollywood. What is sort of startling about New York is a contrast of ordinariness and garbage and glamorous buildings and glamorous people, but they're sort of mixed in with reality that's not camera ready.
I would describe it a little differently. I think films, you know, since the rise of location films is sort of where my book kind of ends, since World War II, there's a kind of a misconception, which is that if you shoot in the real city, you're somehow making something real. You're not making something real. You're making a feature film.
Right.
It's a work of art. It's a drama. It has people reading lines, actors who aren't the real characters. What filmmakers are doing is not so much, I think, prettifying necessarily, because sometimes they may be adding garbage. They're pushing it. They're making it more. They're making it more extreme.
But they leave the city that way anyway. They leave their imprint on the city.
Well, they have the right, and it's in a way their duty to kind of make something more expressive and get every element. What they're trying to do is have, if they're good, is have every element of the setting reinforce what they're trying to do. So if it's a romantic story, they want it all to be, you know, golden and beautiful. And if it's a dark crime story or whatever, it's going to be the other way. I use as an example, you know, this idea, the falseness of this idea about location shooting, to point out about, for example, two films made just within a year of each other, a quarter century ago, Taxi Driver and Annie Hall,
mm-hmm.
both shot on location,
mm-hmm.
both made in the real city, both reflecting mm-hmm. the real city. But how could they be more different?
Right.
And each filmmaker, for his own purposes, Scorsese and Woody Allen, pushed the environment and got out of the environment what they wanted to get out of. So this is a kind of a false idea. They're just using the city really as an armature
mm-hmm.
for an environment or a set.
And also they don't have to go to the city they detest, Los Angeles. I mean, that's a fact. We were talking also about... there's a beautiful photo in here of a recreation, some of these recreations of parts of New York, and its architecture are so painstakingly executed, and they worked on them so carefully for maximum filmic effect. There is a whole hunk of Pennsylvania Station that was built for, which is movie?
The Clock.
An extravagant Vincent Minnelli movie. And that part, that piece, of course, Pennsylvania Station is demolished. To every big tragic demolition there of the real Pennsylvania Station, what still exists of the movie Pennsylvania Station?
Well, that set was really extraordinary, although not oddly enough uncommon for the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1945, and they're going to make a film set in New York, shot all over New York. They you would think, well, we'll just move some cameras into Pennsylvania Station. What are you going to do? Rebuild Pennsylvania
mm-hmm.
Station? Well, that's exactly what they did. It was absolutely par for the course for them. In fact, that same year they made Weekend at the Waldorf, and they recreated the Waldorf. They copied the entire lobby and all sorts of the stenographers' offices and so forth. Once that art department system was up and running and those construction departments were going and those guys were working there two or three shifts a day, it was fairly straightforward for them to build something like Pennsylvania Station. Indeed, that set cost only $67,000. What they built was the centerpiece of the main concourse space, the main waiting room space. Nothing of that set does still exist, except the extraordinary scenic backings that were created to go with it that represented long views that went down the toward 7th Avenue and toward the concourse. And as it happened, I had the extraordinary experience of locating those backings.
Wow.
I found them. They're in the old MGM scenic loft. They've been painstakingly preserved. They were unrolled for me. They're in beautiful shape. And what we're trying to do now is get sponsorship monies together and so forth to do an exhibit. And we would open the exhibit in Grand Central Terminal in the waiting room
Wonderful.
In Vanderbilt Hall,
yeah.
perhaps next year, and put up, let's say, 10 of these amazing backings, which no one has ever seen. We'll put that beautiful one of the hallway, entryway from 7th Avenue, we'll put it right over the entranceway to Vanderbilt
beautiful.
Avenue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. The destruction of Hollywood follows. I mean, once it became a major city, the ruthlessness that happens in a city happened there, and all the... Well, all the stuff is demolished also. So we have barely any record of old Hollywood, do we? And
some of the old standing set street sets
yeah.
still do exist. I had the amazing experience of walking down, for example, there's that Warner Brothers street you saw, and all those unmarked women and all those great old Betty Davis and Humphrey Bogart movies.
Still, right.
That still exists, and I walked down
Well,
there.
They do television on those. I think Laverne and Shirley was shot, even though it took place in Milwaukee.
Those sets are actually the best
New
used.
York, right,
they're very frequently
right,
used. Yeah,
right, and they're used for just sitting around,
mm-hmm.
too, and taking a coffee break. And Paramount, you say, has rebuilt the... I mean, they always had a regular... Oh, in fact, the Laverne and Shirley set wasn't Warner Brothers. It was Paramount. But now you say they've reconstituted new New York. They
yes.
don't have old brownstone New York.
They do.
Old
they do. They have everything. They have about 10 years ago, no more, in 1991, 92, they built a completely new New York Street. So this is not an ancient leftover tradition. It's still alive and well. They built a more ambitious New York Street than probably has ever been built before. It has Washington Square. It's got Fifth Avenue. It's got slums. And it has something the old streets never had. It has Soho. It has cast iron buildings.
And they built a new Paramount, as a matter of fact, to surround it. I promise next week we'll do phone calls, if there is a next week. What is your feeling about redoing Manhattan in the style of movies, in the style of a stage set? For example, the way 42nd Street was done. I mean, that almost brings a cartoon-like quality to the actual city street. The new New York almost follows its image in the movies.
I didn't see it that way. No. I actually,
you're
no.
an architect.
No,
so let's hear what you think.
I actually think that we can do well to look at movies because I think they actually teach us how real space is used.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm less concerned about the style of things, I guess, than the fact that they really, art directors, people like that, really profoundly understand how urban space is used. They have to, because they're trying to tell a story, and they're trying to use the space to tell a story. They're not interested in making a monument. They're not interested in putting something in the pages of a magazine the way architects are, and that's how architects become famous.
Mm-hmm.
They want to push the story, make it as good as they can. They just assume you never look at their sets at all. If you actually are looking at the sets, they've kind of failed. You should be concerned about the people. And that's an amazing way of looking at things, I think, that we would profit well from, architects and planners would profit well from. They never see buildings or streets or urban environment in any way except as the frame of human experience. That's all it means to them, because they don't make movies about buildings.
Mm-hmm.
They only make movies about people. People in buildings, people in spaces, yes, but it's always the people that comes first, the story, the characters. So I have a wonderful quote from Bob Boyle, the great art director who designed North by Northwest, who I saw 2 days ago. He said, a woman is coming home, it's a brownstone, she's lonely maybe, trying to show how lonely he is. He's thinking about the design. I don't care about the room, he said. I don't care about the brownstone, I care about the woman.
And that's what makes a movie. I want to thank you so much. It's a beautiful book, Celluloid Skyline, New York in the Movies, James Sanders. It's published by Knopf. Thanks.
Thank you.
Don't forget, been there, done that, WHYY. Go to Google.com. Check out The Calculating Couple. We're very proud of our work on this series. We're a couple calculating how to live out the rest of our life with the interest rate at 2.5%. I don't know, like stuff like that. It's very funny. And check out RadioForHouston.org on Tuesday night. Bob Fast, Radio Unnameable, will be on WBIX.org tomorrow night at midnight, regular time. And what am I missing? Reno, Rebel Without a Pause, will be extended beginning January 1st. She'll perform on January 1st. I wanted to tell you that next week we will have Great Small Works in Piano, which is based on dramatization of the life and work of Eric Satie, wonderful puppeteer John Bell and his great company, the Great Small Works Company, Trudy Cohen, Stephen Kaplan, Jenny Romaine, Roberto Rossi, and Mark Sussman. They're opening at La Mama Experimental Theater Club, 74A East 4th Street. And let's see, when are they open? It's December 20th to 30th at the La Mama Annex. And call 212-475-7710. These are the same people that last year did the, what was that called? It was a thing based on a Jewish parable. And they do just gorgeous work, John Bell and Great Small Works Company. Now, Saturday, the 22nd, John McDonough, Irish are very good at drama. Isn't that true? Irish people have a long history of being swell on the stage. So we've hooked up with John and a group, a little company of Meshuggah actors, and we're going to do a little play at 101 6th Avenue at Grand Street at 7 p.m. I think you can find out more about this at this number. I can't be positive, but if you get it wrong, I don't know. Go to 101 6th Avenue, 7 o'clock, 646-230-9588. And what else? Did I miss anything, Dave?
We interrupt this substandard broadcast with important news from the Atlantica Radio Empire.
In anticipation of the takeover of your radio station by the Atlantica Radio Empire,
you are invited to witness
and take part in
the free announcer deprogramming sessions already scheduled for your on-air personnel.
But you may say, the announcers on my radio station don't need deprogramming. I like them just the way they are.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
The announcers on your radio station clearly state their opinions and beliefs.
Well, that's the way I like it.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
Our research proves that opinions and beliefs that are mumbled unintelligibly cause less stress, for the listener.
Mumbled opinions cause more stress.
They cause what?
More.
If you cannot understand what it is, you cannot be upset by it.
What did he say?
What you can't understand, you can't be upset by.
No, it isn't.
What you don't know can't hurt you.
Yes, it can.
We hold these truths of religion.
Huh? You hold what?
Truth.
Truth?
Truth.
Truth.
That all men are created equal.
What?
Thank you, Atlantica.
At 99.5 FM, you're listening to WBAI in New York.